Hi, and welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. We're all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of the Ardent Center in Chicago in the Lakeview neighborhood. Though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. I am Hannah Espinoza-Rimas, and I'm a marriage and family therapist, and I'm joined by...
Brittany Brownfield, and I am a child therapist.
And Ben Stover, I am an individual therapist.
And today we are doing Call Me By Your Name. And first, we're going to talk about it in a couple different ways. First, we're going to talk about the family support and acceptance, and then the empowerment as well as identity. And then talking a little bit about Elio and Oliver and kind of how their lives are a little bit different and how that has an effect on how their characters are different, even though we don't know a lot more about Oliver based on the story. And then lastly, we'll discuss treatment.
So I'm going to jump in. I mean, Call Me By Your Name was nominated for an Oscar, which is part of why we picked it. It kind of was up for all the big awards this past year. Mm-hmm. It won for, I think, Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yes.
But it was nominated for all the big ticket items. And it's a story about a 17-year-old boy and, well, young man in Italy. And when their family kind of brings in a graduate student to live with them for the summer, who's 24-ish, I think. Yes. And kind of the relationship that develops between the two of them. So who wants to jump in terms of what did you guys notice in terms of family support and acceptance throughout the movie?
I think for me, what resonated the strongest as far as like family support was the relationship that Elio had with his father. Mm-hmm. I thought that the father showed such an overwhelming amount of acceptance and understanding and letting Elio be who he was without judgment, and just kind of, you know, going through the whole speech that he did at the end was just a absolutely wonderful thing for a father to say to a child, letting mm-hmm. them know, you know, like, hey, you know, like, you know, no matter what, like, I accept you as you are, and I know that you're hurting right now, but you had a beautiful experience with someone, and I kind of envy you for that. And I thought that the dad providing that for something that, particularly, we're talking like 1980s Italy, where this is sent, like, the mm-hmm. like being a gay man is not something that is likely for a father to have been super accepting of.
Which he acknowledges in the speech he gives. Like, yeah. Most parents would hope this goes away.
Right. And he didn't. He went, which is the correct way to handle that, is to allow someone, like, if someone's going, you know, has been identified as gay, as they've come out as gay, that's not something that goes away. It's not something that changes. That's who they are.
Yeah.
And for a father to validate that for a young man who's clearly struggling with his identity and sexuality throughout the movie and mm-hmm. experimenting, like, that, to show that acceptance of just who he is without mm-hmm. judgment and support, and supporting him the same way he would have, maybe even a little bit extra if it were a heterosexual relationship, where he's going, like, hey, you know what, like, you had a beautiful experience, and mm-hmm. you know, that's something that you should treasure and have enjoyed. But I thought, for me, that is what stuck out. And not to diminish the relationship, I guess, with his mother, because his mother also went quite out of her way to show him an acceptance. And I didn't believe the dad for a minute when the kid asked him, do you think mom knows? Like, I think mom knows.
Don't you think he was asking if mom knows? Because dad sort of insinuates, and that's, I mean, this is my interpretation, that he might also be homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least have homosexual leanings. Right, and yeah. I wondered if the kid was asking, does mom know about you?
Ooh, didn't interpret it that way.
That's also how I interpreted it.
But I think the first time I watched it, I thought what you thought, Ben.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, she knows, dude. But then the second time, and I think after me and Hannah talked about it, I was like, oh, maybe he's asking about mom knowing about dad. But I think if no one ever watches this movie, reads the book, if they would just like watch the last speech scene.
Yeah.
That in itself, I think, is something I would like every parent to watch. And really, I think it's such a good example of showing a kid just blanket validation and acceptance, but also acknowledging that they're going through hard times. So feelings validation, not diminishing how the kid's feeling, but also saying just because it's really hard doesn't mean that it's not something you can work through. That's a very delicate thing to balance, even Absolutely. As a therapist, is giving every feeling its due, but also being really real with the client of nothing is a catastrophe. Nothing is forever. There's nothing you can't work through or work past or get over, but that doesn't mean that it's not a feeling that's very potent for you now.
And it also doesn't mean that you have to diminish the good parts mm-hmm. of that, even though maybe it didn't end the way that you wanted it to, that you don't have to let go of that, that you're able to
have all the feelings. I think a lot of times sometimes why people have a harder time as they're growing older is because, like, kind of exactly what he says is you start to shut off parts of yourself in order to deal with or to not deal with the hurt you're feeling, or you start to associate certain experiences with being tragic or bad or not giving you what you needed or wanted, so you just push it all away. Because I mean, in another way, the story could have gone where Ilio totally rejected his sexuality because the love between him and the relationship between him and Oliver didn't quote unquote work out. I think the movie did a really good job of not making it I didn't see it as a tragedy. It was very much just an experience of falling in love with someone, exploring your sexuality with someone, and then leaving kind of on what I thought of as really good terms, because circumstances took them away from each other, not necessarily their decision. And so in another scenario, like, if he hadn't gotten this validation from his dad, he might have been like, this whole experience was bad and I'm just gonna try to be straight. Or, I mean, arguably bisexual, because he does have the relationship with that girl that I don't think was necessarily fake on his part.
Yeah, it doesn't.
No, I don't think so either.
It doesn't seem as though it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think some of the parts that I saw with the family, being a marriage and family therapist, that I thought were really, really showed how vulnerable they were with each other and how open and how they really made a really good setting for a teenager. Teenagers are already struggle so much with who they are and what they need and with everything about who they are, really. And having that, being able to struggle, but also know that your parents are there for you, but also being allowed to have the freedom to learn more about yourself, I think they did a really beautiful job showing that in this movie. Like, I think one of the things I really liked is how often they're very physically comfortable with each other. The way he lays across their lap, the way his mom runs his fingers through his hair, which she does a couple of times kind of to show affection, the way he stops and hugs her a couple of times. I mean, what movie have you ever seen a 17-year-old boy hug his mom that much? B, what 17-year-old have you ever seen hug his mom that much? Like, it's just one of those things that I think they do a really good job of showing that this family has done a really good job of having this loving, open, supportive relationship with each other, where they are able to be very vulnerable and show that side of themselves. And I think that's part of what, with Ilio and Oliver, what makes it hard for them to kind of read each other. Ilio is able to be vulnerable with Oliver in a way that Oliver doesn't kind of understand, because even though we don't know a lot about him, it seems like it's hard for him to feel that way or to understand that kind of feedback. Ilio is pretty upfront with him once they get kind of past that, like, sibling-esque rivalry they kind of
have. Well, once they kind of both know where each other stand in terms of being attracted to each other, Ilio definitely takes more of the risks. And he's more flirtatious. He gets physically closer to him. He challenges him a lot more to take it up a notch in the relationship. Like, he, even though Oliver kisses him first, like, he, like, jumps on his lap and really wants to make out. Like, he is writing him all those love notes. And,
well, even, like, how physically close he stands to him, like, when they're kind of, you know, they're walking around that fountain and they're having this discussion where Ilio is finally just saying, I like you. and mm-hmm. I'm attracted to you and I want to do something mm-hmm. about it.
Right.
And they're kind of both skirting around it, and then they get close to each other and Oliver stops and Ello takes another step towards him.
Yeah.
And like just the way that physically, again, I think showing how he feels about him and how he in his family, how that's something that is really accepted.
I mean, we have to make a lot of assumptions about Oliver's character, because Oliver is the student that comes from America who's staying with them. Their names are very similar, so apologies if you haven't seen the movie and it's confusing. But from the assumptions we make about Oliver based on the little things he says, it sounds like he comes from a kind of quote unquote WASPy community in, like, did you say Massachusetts or New England or something? He is already feels like an outsider because he's the only Jewish family in his community. And he makes little comments like, if my parents knew that I was gay, like, they'd send me off to, like, a reform school or something. And he does seem... He seems like he's surprised when that gay couple comes over to have dinner with them. Like, it definitely seems like the world of Ello and his family and how they operate is very different than what he's familiar with or comfortable with or what he knows in his life. And so you can make an argument that the comfort level they both have with their sexuality goes hand in hand with their familial experiences, the way their family interacts with them and talks to them and treats them. Because a lot of times Oliver makes a lot of disparaging comments about them being physical with each other and sexual with each other. Like, he says, we're still good. I want to be good. We haven't done anything yet to be ashamed of.
I thought that was a huge,
that was, that made me,
yeah,
my heart go out.
Yeah. That was hard to see, because you're seeing this man who's clearly, like, struggling with expressing his sexual identity.
Well, he definitely has an idea that that is not good and it's something to feel bad about, like being gay,
right,
is bad.
It's bad. It's something that you can't do. You just can't do it. It's not allowed. But I mean, that's clearly the direction that he wants to go. I think the thing that's important is what we see, like, we're talking about family support and acceptance, is seeing, like, the difference in the two characters where and how they acted, because we saw, like, Ello wanting to, like, we mean, part of it is he's also 17 and mm-hmm. Oliver's a little older, but you're seeing this person who's trying and feels empowered to go for his feelings and just engage and act on them without worrying so much about, like, the societal judgments of it
mm-hmm.
and feeling like it's forbidden from his family. I mean, we get the sense that he knows it's not normal, not right per se, but mm-hmm. it's not a completely on the taboo, on the unallowed, on the shameful side of things. Whereas for Oliver, he clearly does not have that acceptance. He's like, you know, it's, I think you mentioned it, his family told him, or he said he'd be, what, incarcerated?
Institutionalized, like, or something like that.
Yeah, somewhere like that. But that shows a pretty clear understanding that the acceptance in his family is conditional.
Yes, very much so. And it seems like Ello, whether he even understood it consciously, felt more secure in that his parents would still love him. Like, even after he and Oliver say goodbye to each other and he's really upset, he calls his mom and asks her to pick him up. And he clearly knows he's in a space where he can't hide how upset he is.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like he even hesitates in reaching out to his mom and letting her see him in that state. And she does a good job in that it seems like she doesn't ask him any questions when they go home, which is good. People might not think that's good, but she's kind of letting him have his feelings and kind of doing a thing which I really like, which is let your kid tell you what they want to tell you when they're ready to tell you about it. Sometimes, even as therapists, as parents, as people who love other people, we want to kind of be proactive with being engaged with them. Like, hey, I feel like, you know, something's going on. Is there anything you want to tell me? And though that's not a bad thing to do, I think sometimes where it's more powerful is if you kind of just are present with the kid and let them know that when you're ready to tell me, I'm ready to hear. And that can just be literally just being around them, being tender like they are in the movie. Like in the car, she's just very quiet and she's just letting him cry and she's not saying anything.
Right. And she just is like physically, she like touches his hair, I think, again. But also I think it's, they say to him a couple of times in the movie, they say to him, we're here for you.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Which again, is I think giving that space to your child, really no matter how old they are, to be able to allow them to experiencing some things that they need to experience in order to have new experiences and to really kind of branch out from being with their parents all the time. And that, but also knowing that you can go and do these things, but also it's okay if it didn't go well and you want to come back and talk to us about it. Or if there's something different that you want to tell us. Or I think that's one of the things that really stayed with me in this movie was how awesome it is that he can call his mom and say, I need to be picked up.
Yeah.
I need to be picked up. And he doesn't have to say anything else. And she doesn't ask any questions. And she just comes and gets him. And he goes home and then has this, you know, really kind of magical discussion with his dad.
Yeah.
And even in that moment, his dad's not probing him, like expecting any answers from him, wanting any definitions about what his and Oliver relationship was. He kind of just laid it out there and it was kind of do with this what you will. But I'm not expecting, he wasn't expecting anything from Elio in right. that moment.
Right.
No, and even like, I like that he took, like when he was about halfway through the speech or so, like he took the moment to go, have I spoken mm-hmm. out of turn?
Yeah. I was just going to bring that up.
Like he checked in with him and I thought that was a great opportunity, and I really liked just the way that the father portrayed himself, or the way the father actor portrayed the father character. Like he was gentle and approachable, and he talked about his experience, and he didn't pry or
and he
probe.
Didn't make it about him either.
He didn't. He shared a little bit about himself, which as therapists we're taught like easy on that, but
yeah.
He used it in a way that even if I were supervising him as a therapist, I would be okay with that. I'm like, okay, you self-disclosed there, but you used it in a way that benefited the client.
And you didn't make it about you, or and, even right. very specific.
Right. And I thought that was really important. And another thing that I wanted to point out, because I find a lot of value in the alternative therapies, or the expressive arts therapies, I guess is the correct term I want to use here. And the parents, the mom in particular, I thought she was very strategic in the way she would do things. Like she mm-hmm. she kind of manipulated
them going away together.
Mm-hmm. But reading the story, the way yes. she read that story about the French knight who, mm-hmm. you know, came up with struggling with being in love with the character and like, is it mm-hmm. better to speak or to die was the question.
Yeah.
And I thought that was wonderful because that is the way that drama therapy works, is that they don't explore like a set script or something. Like if the therapist is aware that say, like if we're talking, it's often used in reintegration for soldiers, and they can use that, like they'll have the kids act out kind of a story about like a king who's coming back to his kingdom, or find some other way to metaphorically represent the story without saying it, so that you can get the exploration of it in a different space, much like we're doing with this podcast, where we can help people like see through the eyes of another character, which can be easier to assume and easier to identify with than turning it towards yourself. It can allow like a different level of vulnerability and spontaneity with real feelings. And I think that is a brilliant move on the mom's part and something that parents can learn from, because when you're trying to manipulate someone into exploring more information, you can do that by bringing up other situations without drilling at someone or interrogating them to find out the information you want.
Yeah, and it was also, it also seemed clear that she had read the story to Oliver in some context, because when Elio comes out and says, oh, my mom is reading this, he's like, oh yeah, the story about
the knight and the princess.
And so I was just like, oh man, is she like just like massaging this? Like, noticing that they're both having feelings and helping them discover that, but like also not telling them to do anything, but just saying like, here's the story, kind of like what you were talking about, Ben, here's the story, and having them, and then think about it about themselves. I mean, I think it was really, just really a really interesting and kind way to help somebody realize something.
I mean, it's a good example, kind of what you said, Ben, of bibliotherapy, which is kind of book therapy, which I've used with kids, which is when you're not exactly able to talk about something yourself or even conceptualize what's going on with you. Sometimes reading, suggesting a book for them to read that has a similar theme can be really enlightening, or just helps them identify with somebody in the story, and then they can apply it to their life, and then it can be a catalyst. Like in the movie, it was very much a catalyst for Ilio finally being upfront with Oliver about how he feels.
Very much so. And I thought that that was just a wonderful way to do it. And the other thing I wanted to cover with support before maybe we move on to a little bit more with empowerment with development is that the level of trust the parents started to show in Ilio by letting him go on the trip and giving him freedom to explore and to start exploring what it's like to be an adult with a less supervision and more opportunity to have experiences on your own, I thought it was an important thing. And sometimes we don't see that in our culture here, where the culture seems to be shifting towards like ever more structure for kids and more and more supervised activities. Like Sandlot baseball like isn't a thing anymore. I was listening to a radio show this morning on my way to the office, and they were talking about with the author or the director of Sandlot, who was, you know, they were talking about it, and I was realizing that I do not see kids in parks outside of uniforms. Like if they're not wearing uniforms, they're not out playing ball.
Like and pick up or anything?
Nothing. And I feel like there's some degree of development that has to happen on your own. And like particularly once you start getting into upper teen years, people have to learn on their own. And sometimes it takes a little less supervision where you know, you have to let people experience the world. You don't have to let them get into dangerous situations, but the parents letting this kid go and experience what life might be like on his own a little bit was, or I thought, a really important part of his development.
Well, because you're instilling confidence in the kid that you trust that they can make their own choices. And the reason why you trust that they can make their own choices is because you believe they have the skills and the ability to do so. And so a lot of times when you micromanage a kid, whether you realize it or not, you're telling them, I don't trust you to make your own choices. I don't trust you have the ability to make your own choices and to make the correct choices and to be smart about it. So I'm going to do it for you. Whereas in this situation, which seems counterintuitive a little bit, like if you give your kid more freedom, they're going to screw up or do something crazy or get pregnant or something. Really, you're showing them, once you show someone that I trust you to take this in your own hands, a lot of times people will take you up on that because they want to impress you now that you've trusted them with this much space, and they want to keep that relationship going. And so more often than not, people will live up to the challenge of freedom that you've given them because they don't want to blow it, or because they're so complimented, flattered by the trust you've given them that they want to do right by that. And I don't think it's that explicit in this movie, but I think those are like the subconscious vibes that go on, which is why when you give kids a little freedom, that doesn't always go awry, because you're teaching them to trust themselves and to trust their abilities. And also, and this is also what I really liked about the car ride home where she didn't ask any questions, is acknowledging that you don't need to know everything about your kid's life to keep them safe, because that's, as the parent, more trying to quell your own anxiety about what might be going on with the kid. And you don't need to know all your kids' secrets. They can have secrets from you. And I don't mean big ones, but they're allowed to have their own independence. And part of having your own independence is having parts of your life that you keep to yourself. And then that's okay. And that if they want to share that with other people, they'll choose to do that. So that's what I really love too about the end part, about her not asking questions in the car, is acknowledging that he's allowed to have his own secrets and his own life.
Right, and I think they did a great job with that when they talked to him. And they did two things with it that I like. They let him know, you can always talk to us. But I thought that it was nice that they reinforced that, but they also validated him, which is a thing that is so often missed. If you want somebody to talk to you, you have to be able to also validate what might feel uncomfortable for the kid. And they did that because when they were having the conversation, when the kid was like, I almost had sex with the girl. And the dad was like, why didn't you? Like, and I realized, you know, yeah. you can always talk to us and know that this was like two separate scenes, but they're pretty close together. And then,
mm-hmm. they are.
But then it's like, you know, I realize you may not want to talk with us about such things, but if you do, we're always here and you can talk to us. And I think that's a hugely important thing to just let somebody know that, hey, I know this is maybe not what you want to do, or that this might be weird or uncomfortable for you, but, you know, we're here if you do decide that that's safe and we want that to be safe for you.
That is a pretty enlightening part in the movie when he tells his dad. I don't know if that was him just because he's that comfortable with his parents that he'll talk to them about sex, or if he was putting on a front in front of Oliver, like, I like girls and or I'm a sexual being. Do you think I'm a sexual being? It felt very like 17-year-old.
It felt like...
But the dad did a good job responding to it.
Exactly. Like, I think the dad did a really good job of responding to what he had to say, but also I think it was a little bit of Elio just kind of putting it out there that he has women who are interested in him. And especially after, because I think that was the night after the dance party, right?
Yeah, where Oliver was making out with that girl, too.
Right. So I think he was kind of putting it out there like, I know that, like, you're attractive and you can get girls, but so can I. And this is what almost happened. So I think it's kind of a combination, but I do agree that, again, when parents are given the opportunity to do what they say they wanted to do, which is to come to me with anything, literally, instead of feeling awkward or weird about it, just saying, oh, well, why didn't you? What stopped you? What was going on?
Which is the 1-2 punch of being an open parent like that. I guess the very common example is if you're at a party and everyone's drinking and you've been drinking, call me instead of, and I will come pick you up, no questions asked. But if that happens, you have to be cool. If your kid calls you and they're drunk and you drive them home, you cannot punish them. You know what I mean? You have to be cool about it.
Right. You can't then turn that around and use that against them because then you violated the trust. Like, do you need to have a conversation about drinking and being safe? Yes.
Right.
I mean, if they violated preset rules, is that something that needs to be part of that discussion? Absolutely. We're not saying, like, let your kids run wild because that's what they're going to do. But
kids are
going to experiment. Like, that's going to happen. You did it.
Mm-hmm.
We all did it. Everyone experimented in some way, shape, or form. And when you have the opportunity to be that safety net that you provided, mm-hmm. I think that's a huge point. Is like, you have to be...
You have to follow through with that.
Safe, right?
And I guess a good point to bring up is that Elio seems like a pretty, quote-unquote, well-behaved kid. Like, he's not really getting into trouble. He seems to, like, he has a lot of safe interests, like writing music, stuff like that. So, I mean, this might be a different conversation if Elio was a kid who was acting out or lashing out or doing risky things. But... And then his parents would have to maybe change up how they behave towards him. Because we're not telling you guys to all be like cool moms and cool dads and just like let their kid do whatever they want. But it's because they have raised this kid to be a self-assured person and that they're trusting him because of what he's already shown them.
Right. That they can trust him. It's kind of the idea that he's already been in this environment. He's already been in this family dynamic where he has been trusted and it has worked out and his parents have confidence in him. And it's kind of this pattern of, as long as you keep being able to be the person we believe that you are, we're going to keep letting you do things because we trust you, we believe in you. But also if something happens, you can come back and tell us, and that's okay too. Like, you're allowed to have all of those different levels of experiences. And so I think... that's one of the things that I think is really, it's just something that we just don't see in movies.
We don't see a lot of, there's usually, in the movies that I've seen, there's usually, like I said, like the cool mom who's too easygoing and kind of lets the kid do whatever they want and is kind of negligent. Or there's like the hyper all over the kid parent with a lot of rules and structured and like no fun.
Yeah.
And so this was, and it does feel very European, kind of how you said, Ben. But this is one of the few times I've watched a movie where the parents are really killing it at that balance of being easygoing and allowing the kid to explore, but also being very present. And I'm sure having rules that we never heard them explicitly state, like I'm sure they had things like you have a, he probably has some form of a curfew or, you know, because there are certain, there's one scene where he goes, I can't go out tonight. If I go out, they'll freak.
Right.
Because there are, he does have boundaries.
Yes.
I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like a boundaryless household.
Right. I mean, I think in general, like an important part to make is that, you know, that this kid was shown as following a fairly typical pattern of development. Like he was, in general, like portrayed as a good kid who'd been
really well adapted, well-adjusted, right. Stable kid.
Right. Who, you know, isn't showing a pattern that we are aware of getting into deviant behavior or being in trouble a lot or bringing the police to the door. Like, if those things are happening, that's a different discussion. But as far as, like, someone that's showing a typical and expected pattern of behavior, I think the parents did a really good job of showing what it can be like to have a trusting, safe relationship with a child and how that leads to empowerment and development with this kid's identity and sexuality, which he was fairly free to explore.
Yes.
And...
and even when he started... helped. And even when he started wearing that Star of David necklace, which he... stated earlier in the movie that his parents weren't, like, all over. They don't really self-identify as prominently Jewish or, like, they don't really show that they're Jewish.
Yeah.
He makes a point of saying in the beginning, and that's
like
why he doesn't...
clandestine Jewish.
Yeah,
or
and that's
like
why he
that.
Doesn't wear his necklace. But when he starts wearing that necklace, his mom sees it. She acknowledges it, but she doesn't say anything of one way or another. She's not like, why are you wearing that now? Or, like, we don't do that.
Right.
She just goes, oh, okay. It's like she just kind of acknowledges, okay, you're trying this out.
Right.
And maybe because you saw Oliver wearing his. But she doesn't make fun of him, tease him. She doesn't ask why. She just kind of lets it lay.
No, and she, like, I struggle with how I interpret what she did. Because, like, from, like, a film point of view, it could have been conveying a couple things. But when they, like, they showed mom right after they, like, put her hand right over the Star of David on his chest.
Pats him on the chest.
Yeah, but, like, that was, like, for sure right in the middle of her hand. And I wasn't sure figuring out if that was, like, mom, like, so showing some kind of protective thing with him or, like still, like, trying to include him in her family by covering that up or if that was just her, like, pressing that into his chest. I wasn't sure, like, I'm showing you right now by, like, tactile support, putting this on your chest, showing you, like, I'm supporting you, expressing your
identity.
Like,
I'm acknowledging it.
Right.
Well, I think the more we've talked about the other parts of it, it seems more aligned with her behavior that she was just kind of acknowledging it. I mean, I could be wrong in what the director meant, but that's how it felt when it happened. Because she made that kind of like, oh, mom face when she did it.
Right.
She did. The first time we saw the movie, I thought she was going to hide it. She was going to put it underneath his shirt so that you wouldn't be able to see it. But then that's not what she does. She just kind of, and again, just kind of accepts him and accepts that he's, and again, because it's not that big of a deal. So what if he's wearing a necklace that Oliver also happens to have? Let him, if he wants to talk about it, let him talk about it. That whole thing where he's allowed to have things that he keeps to himself that are, that don't need to, kids don't have to tell you every single thing about themselves. Part of having a healthy identity is knowing that there's some things you're allowed to keep to yourself.
And to be different from your parents or to be, and that's okay. And I thought that was really well done with him too. Like every, like, aspect of his identity that they let him explore, like, they showed that they supported him and showed him that they valued things that, you know, they didn't do. We didn't see, I don't believe, the parents playing instruments at all, right?
No.
No, I don't think so.
The mom was more like a literature person, the dad anthropology, and then him music.
Right.
Yeah.
And they all supported each other's things and, like, validated each other's identity and shared in each other's successes within their field. Like, they all, the kids spoke different languages, like mom, and they all sat and read together. But they all also sat and let Elio bask in his identity of, like, you saw the kid transcribing music. Like, that's not easy to do. Like, I'm a musician. That's hard. I can't do that. I can't sit and write down
the
notes.
I took piano and I can't imagine doing that.
No.
I would say, honestly, the only time that his dad or either of his parents get in his face is when he's being homophobic about the couple coming over to visit, the gay couple, which kind of does demonstrate that his parents do have expectations of him, which is to be polite. Like, he's like, when we ask you to play piano, you're going to play piano. Like, they have expectations of being a kind, polite person. So that does, they do show in the movie, like, we have morals and values that you are going to, because he even says, you look, it looks bad on me if you act this way. And, but in, not in a very, like, I want you to be a version of me, but in a, these are our values and morals. And, you know, and we expect you to be kind in that way. That's the only time he really puts his foot down, is when he feels like Elio's being unkind.
And he also seems to also kind of do it in a very kind of gentle way. I mean, he's kind of joking with him, and he's like, you're going to do this, and you're going to be a credit to me, and this is what's going to happen. And he's just kind of silly with him, and it's not this big, serious conversation that he's having with him about this. Like, it's kind of like, no, you're going to wear the shirt, and it's going to be fine, and it's going to be a good time. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was very, I really liked him. I really like the dad a lot. Know. I like the way that
he's silly in a way just, that's so nice to see. Like, I mean,
his parents, to see an adult man or just adult people act silly in a way that makes sense and that seems healthy. I mean, I think if we're all serious all the time, that's just not very much fun.
Well, and also, seeing a lot of men in this movie that are very sensitive and tender and tender with how they like touch people, like not just the two people that are sexual with each other,
right?
Because there is a lot of really naturalistic tenderness between the two of them, which I don't feel like I've ever seen in a movie, in how naturalistic it felt.
And
not all of it's sexual, like him rubbing his feet, and just the dad and the mom are very touchy with each other, even though they may or may not have, who knows what the sexuality of their relationship's like, if dad is homosexual, and that they are very touchy with Oliver, and everyone's kiss, and it's very sweet and tactile, and there seems to be no real, in their household, strong gender roles beliefs. Like, men do this, women do this, you know.
No, no, it doesn't seem to be at all. It seems like the tasks in the house are split, and everybody has expectations to be professional, but also to take care of the house and the family. And they also had a housekeeper, though, who...
They had money. They had money, so that does help with stuff like this. And I think what I really liked about this movie, going on to, like, identity, is I really felt like this movie was very realistic in how it portrayed being 17, trying to figure out who the hell you are. And, like, I think this movie would be really empowering for anybody to see who struggle with identity at that age, or kids that are that age. Like, him, the kind of mishmash of him kind of wanting to be Oliver but also being attracted to Oliver. I read an article a while back about this movie. I apologize, because I don't remember who wrote it or where I saw it or anything like that, so I'm just totally stealing this person's ideas with no credit. But it was written by a gay man, and it sort of talked about the themes of, for him, and I don't know how generalized this is, and people feel free to email us if they have shared experiences or if I'm totally off base, because I, if you can't tell, I am a woman, not a gay man, so I don't have personal experience. But in trying to figure out who you are as a gay man in the article, he was saying a lot of it is this kind of mishmash combination of being attracted to older men that you idolize and they're also attracted to. And so it can be very, not confusing, but can be all mixed up in terms of, do I want to be like them? Do I want to be with them? And that made a lot of sense reading it, and it added a lot of depth to me watching this movie. And I can't imagine what that's like, because I know as a young girl, like, you are constantly trying to figure out who you are by looking at other people. So I couldn't imagine what that would have been like if added to it an attraction to older girls as well. Like, I can see how that would play out and how that would be kind of confusing, because he does a lot of things in this movie, like wearing the Star of David necklace, wanting to wear Oliver's shirt, like shaving his mustache, which did not exist as far as I could tell. And it's all this, like, trying to figure out who I am by emulating someone else. But you could also argue that it's because when you like someone, especially at that age, you kind of want to, like, dive into their body. Like, you kind of want to just, like, totally envelop yourself in them too. So it did a good job of addressing both those things. And I just like that he looked like a 17-year-old boy. He was skinny and kind of goofy and regular. He looked like a regular, like not like these hyper buffed out boys that you see in like every CW show that exists now that are like supposedly 17, but they look like they're 28 with like a gym membership.
Yeah.
And a trainer.
Exactly. And like a keto diet.
Exactly. I think that one of the things that it portrays really well is kind of what you said, Brittany, which is just being 17 and how kind of tricky that is, but also how horny you are. Oh yes. My God. I thought he did such a good job of with Marcia as well as with Oliver, just kind of that intensity, but also that those feelings that are so specific to being that age and being in love or really wanting to just fuck everybody that you meet. And so I think that he did such a good job of showing that, like physically, as well as the way that he responded to Oliver and to Marcia in that way.
I mean, even the scene where he, this is a bit of an explicit statement, but he masturbates into a peach, even, or an apricot, even that didn't feel, it felt, I didn't feel grossed out like this is such a sexually gross, weird thing to do, like an American Pie when he has sex with that pie. Oof. It felt more like, oh my God, this kid is just so horny and just trying to figure out who he is that he's just kind of like doing whatever his body tells him to do. And, yeah. But I think the movie did a good job of, after that happens and Oliver discovers the peach, him having that kind of emotional breakdown of, am I a sexual monster? You know, well, that's how I interpreted it, of like, I'm, you know, having sex with a woman, having sex with a man, having sex with this piece of fruit. Like, what is wrong with me? And I think what was also kind of part of the acceptance and validation is, even in that moment, Oliver makes a joke about him having sex with a piece of fruit. But then even when he starts crying, he doesn't. He just lets him cry and pats his head and tells him that he's good or he's okay or fine or whatever. Like, it's not a big deal. Just continues to validate to him that this isn't a big deal. Nothing you do is like a defining moment of who you are in that way.
No, not by that point in the movie. What I thought was interesting, though, is with Oliver, with him and this identity, like reinforcement, like Oliver was struggling with his own, and there were times, multiple times, where Oliver would shut him out, and they, you know, made very clear to do that. Like the one time when he came home late at night, like after they'd had some interactions, I don't remember whether they'd had like sex or if they'd kissed and just,
I think it's after they went to the, where he took him to his special place and they like kissed.
Yeah. And then he shuts the door, like doesn't say anything to him. Like doesn't come in, like just makes a point to like come in quietly, just like, shut the door and shut him out. And the camera was zoomed like right in on that door when that happened. Like, see, I thought it was interesting, like the way that we see like this blend, like this person that he's romantically linked to now, sort of, is struggling with his own identity so much that he's shutting him out.
Yeah, because once they ripped the band-aid off of knowing, of saying that they were attracted to each other, Elio was like all in. He was like, get into it. And Oliver continuously gives him outs, which is appropriate in a certain extent. Like, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure?
Right.
But also, he keeps, it's almost like he's trying to be like, are you sure? Because this is bad.
Yeah.
It seems to be the rest of that sentence. Like, even after they have sex the first time, even though Elio does act a little cagey because I think he's trying to process it, Oliver's first assumption is like, did I fuck you up, kind of? Like, did I molest you or screw with you? Because Oliver, I think, is still really struggling with, this is a sinful act, and I already think I'm bad for having these thoughts, and now I'm creating these thoughts in another young man. The movie to me didn't feel predatory, but it felt like, at moments, Oliver felt like he was being a predator, even though Elio didn't take it that way.
Yeah, I think because it seems as though, and again, we don't know a lot about Oliver, but it seems as though he's had some narrative of shame around his feelings, around interactions with any sexual interactions he's had with other men or whatever. So it's just kind of, I feel like Oliver is kind of hard to figure out a lot of the time, but I feel like in that scene where they're waking up from having that, from sleeping together, and how he kind of, you can tell it's all over his face. Like he sees that Elio's kind of being distant from him, and it's very clear that he doesn't really know what to do because he's kind of been vulnerable and he's gone through with this, even though he's already made all these reasons why they couldn't, kind of put all these barriers in the way where, you know, kind of shutting Elio down and telling him, no, we have to be good, we have to do these things. And how it really seems to throw him off when Elio acts a little bit distant after that happens, and how he kind of wants to take the power back.
Mm-hmm.
After they come back from that swim, where he tells them to come to the doorway,
mm-hmm.
says, take your pants off, and kind of reestablishes that, no, like, you still are hot for me, and this was okay, and I'm just gonna leave it like that, and then if you want to do anything else, you let me know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, something I caught on to, like, as far as sexuality.
Yeah.
We've clearly touched on that a lot, and it's obviously a story about a young man exploring whether or not he may be gay or if he's bisexual, and like exploring sexual identity. Like, we see him with a woman for the first time. We'll also see him with this man for the first time. But something that stuck out to me from doing this podcast and after watching 50 Shades of Bullshit was watching that I saw some things out of Oliver that stuck out to me, and I was going, like, he is showing multiple signs of domination things. Like, he, in multiple times throughout the movie, only gave attention to Elio when Elio conformed to the way he wanted to do things. Hmm. Like, if he didn't respond to a touch the way that he wanted to, he'd shut him out. If he didn't keep playing the song the way he wanted to, he walked away. He showed multiple times of, like, establishing his dominance in the relationship.
But I think they were both doing that. Like, he asked Elio to play that song again, and Elio stopped and made him follow him. But I get what you're saying. I think it's, in that argument, I would probably think it's all control-based because it's such a scary concept for sure. Oliver, that he wants to have ultimate control and ultimate understanding, confirmation of what's going on, before he will commit to anything one way or the other. Because
right.
for him, this has got to be like the ultimate risk, is acting out on his homosexuality.
Right. Right. I wouldn't say it's like the same as like getting into a BDSM relationship.
Yeah.
But
right.
what I saw was that in like the development of the relationship
mm-hmm.
out of Oliver, and I noticed that like right away with him, there's some things that struck me as a little predatory, possibly, because
mm-hmm.
He is older, and there's like he
yeah.
was doing like some of the, like the touching and like the lingering, the extra touch, like you're like
mm-hmm.
kind of testing the water and experimenting, which could be seen as grooming. Like, this movie clearly didn't depict
yeah.
it that way. I don't know. I've heard that the book does more so, and it seems more predatory. I haven't read the book, but what I just noticed and stuck out to me was that Oliver was very specific about his needs and wants, and like if Elio didn't respond in the way he wanted, he'd be like, all right, see you later.
Yeah. And I think I would just argue that that's all. I mean, if we're going to really compare him to Christian Grey, oh, dude, what a disservice. But
they're both
people that are very scared of being open and vulnerable, and so they want control over their relationship yeah. so that they can feel less scared. And I think that's true of both of them, for sure. Christian, because, all that stuff.
Yeah.
You can listen to that episode. Ugh. And Oliver, just because being gay, especially 30 years ago, it's probably around the AIDS panic. I mean, even nowadays, is a risk you take. Deciding to be open about your sexuality is still a risk. And back then, you know, it was way, way, way more of a risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Way more of a risk.
There's so many more ways that you could be ostracized, I would imagine. I mean, like, I don't know. But it seems as though being ostracized at that time was quite a bit more severe.
Yeah.
And a lot more, the culture that you were in or were around, there was so much more, people were so much more against it. And had all these thoughts and ideas about what that meant if you were homosexual mm-hmm. and how there was really severe outcomes like losing your job, there's all different kinds of things that could happen that I
yeah.
think. I also think that Oliver has had some experiences where things have gone wrong. And I feel like I feel like he is feeling out Elio a little bit more and trying to make sure that he is interested. But also I could see both sides. I mean, I think it's hard because we don't know that much about Oliver, and I wish that we knew a little bit more about him. But I do know, I tried to read the book by the time we did this, but I just didn't have enough time. But I did start reading it, and it does seem as though it might be a little bit more predatory than the movie is. I am glad that the movie doesn't really seem to go down that vein, because really it just is to me, seems just like a kind of a beautiful story about two people falling in love and having this experience, and how, you know, kind of beautiful what that could actually look like.
Well, I mean, it definitely is kind of a utopian environment in which this kid is able to explore his sexuality to the max. Like, he's able to weave in and out of how he feels about men, women, himself, without the worry of repercussions. I mean, even with the conversation with his parents, there doesn't seem to be a lot of fear coming out of him, you know, other than regular fear of, I'm still trying to figure out who I am, and what if what I am is bad, which could be a lot of context. But sure. Yeah, but he does have, like I said, like a kind of a utopian experience of being able to feel himself out, both literatively and figuratively. Yes. But, so I guess, do we want to go into the treatment?
Poor kid getting caught masturbating.
It's so heartbreaking the first time I saw that movie, and when he burst into tears, and because he's just so confused and so horny, like he doesn't know what to do with himself. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was handled really well.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah.
And I mean, and the thing with Oliver, and I mean, what you can take from it, the fact that the movie kind of ends with him like 6 months later-ish.
Yeah.
And he's already engaged to get married to a woman. I think that kind of says everything we need to know about Oliver and what he thinks is acceptable in his life.
Right.
Because I wonder if he went back to that woman and pumped it up a notch by getting married, because his experience with Elio was so powerful and probably really enlightening to him about what he actually truly wants, and that probably freaked him out so much that he doubled down when he got home to shut it down.
Oh yeah, to shut it down, to fully commit to the hetero lifestyle and just
continue on this path.
Things have been off and on with this woman, but now I'm gonna lock in, and this is what I'm gonna follow.
Yeah. So in terms of treatment, what did you guys think?
It was hard. It was hard for me to think about treatment in this movie, only because, for a couple of reasons. One, because it's hard. We don't know that much about Oliver, and so that makes it hard to really, I would imagine you would be more likely to see him than you would be to see Elio in treatment. I did wonder if what Oliver and his wife's relationship looked like, and if it would be hard for them to maintain intimacy in their relationship if he wasn't kind of being able to be who he really is, and having to kind of shut down that part of himself, which also can mean that you're not able to be open to have good intimacy with your partner, because mm-hmm. you're having a hard time because you can't be who you are and you have to hide something from them, mm-hmm. and how that can really make a relationship flounder in some ways. So I imagine seeing Oliver and his wife and kind of having to help them talk about communication, or really be able to help them communicate, and maybe making a safe space for him to be able to talk about that by that time. I mean, it seems as though, from reading the parts of the book that I have read, that he stays married.
Yeah. But I would argue, could you even do couples counseling with a couple where the guy has a big secret? Because I don't think they were going to work through him being gay in couples counseling. It would probably still be hidden.
I think it would be one of those things where, when you do individual assessment, you know, when I see a couple, I see them first individually, and then I see each person individually to help kind of try and assess if they're in a place to get treatment at that time. And I think it would depend on whether or not he even told me. I mean, in all honesty, there's a chance that you do the individual assessment and he doesn't even tell me about it. Mm-hmm. And then you're just doing communication and can't quite put your finger on it as a therapist of what is just a little bit off in this setting. And that might be more of what would happen. So I don't, so Treatment was hard. I don't really have anything more to say about that, because I feel like I don't know that Elio would end up in therapy, because he's had, this has kind of been a positive experience for him in some ways, even though it has been hard at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I think that if I were to, I'll start with Elio. I think that for Elio, like, the his father did a great job. Mm-hmm. I know we've, like, hammered that in, but
it's just so beautiful.
It is. And it is inspiring to me as I'm about to have a child, like, to, like, yes, watch that and go, like you know, I, that kind of guidance is what I want to be able to provide. Mm-hmm. And seeing that was inspirational for me. But like, what I want to see, like, or what I want to do with Elio, honestly, is process grief and work with him on just acceptance. Like, his family did a good job. I don't think he would likely struggle with too much of that from his family. And the girl that he had slept with and then kind of forgot about for 3 days, which was...
Oh, Marcia.
that was upsetting for her. But then I think his mom had a conversation with her. Maybe it was off screen, it was subtext. But I think the mom kind of let her know what was going on, which is why she forgave him and became friends. But I think for him, you'd want to explore the grief of it, and allowing it, like, you know what, it's... You need to process that this is a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people think of grief only as death.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think as a therapist, that's something that I try to cover with people. Like, grief can come from many things, and you need to process it in much the same way. Like, grief can come from a loss of a job, a loss of a relationship, loss of a pet.
The loss of the idea of something.
Loss of your identity, yeah. Loss of identity, loss of, really, of just about anything.
Right, anything that had meaning to you.
Yeah.
Right, it can be, there's lots of things that can be grief. And I think one of the most important things that we only a little bit hinted at that I would want to communicate as a therapist is similar to what the dad told him, and something that you have to cover with clients a lot, is that if you shut out the bad, you are also shutting out the joy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't block off the experience. It's a hugely important thing to be able to experience the whole life and allow the emotion to come in like a wave and go out like a wave. It's important to be able to be mindful of that. So I think with him, I would want to work from a person-centered point of view on just acceptance and allowing him to explore with the unconditional positive regard that he gets a lot of his family. We don't know what he gets in the society. One thing that mm-hmm. I think is interesting about this movie and that would want to be explored with him is we see nothing about his identity with peers other than this girl. True. Like, nothing. And I suspect we would see more hesitance to mm-hmm. explore his, like, the sexual identity of being gay or bi or whatever it is that he's going to choose to identify as. But I think working with him on how you express your identity and how you deal with your identity that might be seen, particularly at that point in time, as deviant.
Yeah.
And how you express that identity. So for him, person-centered and grief counseling would be really where I would want to provide work. For Oliver, is likely to be far more complicated.
Yeah.
Far more complicated. Because we don't know what kind of couple stuff might be able to do. I agree with Hannah. I think that would be pretty tricky to do because we don't know what he would be even willing to disclose.
Yeah.
But like with him, if you were to get him individual, I think working with him, probably cognitive behavioral would be a pretty important thing with him because there are all sorts of negative automatic thoughts that are clearly represented with him to the point that they may even be core beliefs that if yeah. you do this, you are bad.
Yeah.
And because I have these interests, because I have gay interests, I am bad. And then he just holds on to that as a fundamental truth, which means that he's always going to be in conflict with his identity. And you can't be in conflict with your identity and be psychologically healthy. You have to find a peace with it and an acceptance of who you are. And I don't think he has that. And I would want to target that, that core belief and those automatic thoughts that he has that this is shameful, this is mm-hmm. bad. And like work on reprogramming how he thinks about that to take the judgment and the context off it and go like this more like this is as opposed to this is good or bad. Like this just yeah. is. This is how I am. Mm-hmm. So that would be what I would want to do. So Elio, person-centered in grief. Oliver, I would... there's a lot of person-centered, but for sure want to hit some CBT with him.
Yeah, I mean, I think similar as you guys, it was hard to think of treatment because this is one of those beautiful circumstances where it seems to be done right with the main character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess, I mean, I would maybe, I think a lot of the stuff they do right, I suggest in treatment to people. With my do psychoeducation for parents is being very open, you know, not helicoptering, having boundaries, but also being feelings oriented, not feeling like you need to know the kid's secrets, giving the kid breathing room, all that stuff's beautiful. And yeah, the only thing I would think with Ilio might be if he was struggling to own his identity and sexuality in a bigger context, like you were saying, Ben, with his friends and peers. So that might be, because it is still the 80s, you know, being gay isn't as prevalent or as in the pop culture as it is now, kind of universally known and not as accepted as it should be, but more, way more accepted. Mm-hmm. And so I could see him maybe seeing him and helping him continuing to work on his identity. Like, who does he think he is? What does being gay mean to him? Kind of more like existential questions. Like, who are you if you're gay? Who are you if you're straight? Who do you want to be? You know, if I don't know how aware people were in the 80s of being bisexual versus being gay versus being straight versus being questioning. So, you know, there might be a lot of questions about that or confusion within himself of what am I? And so kind of maybe helping him get away from a label if that's what he's stressed about. Mm-hmm. And then I would say with Oliver, I can't imagine that at some point in his life, therapy wouldn't be helpful. I mean, my assumption for him, which is not positive, would be that he tries to be straight and live this straight lifestyle for many years. And by 40, he's probably going to be miserable and struggling and probably a lot of internalized, like you said, Ben, self-hatred. And that might come out in a myriad of ways, mm-hmm. like addiction, alcoholism, abuse, you know, or maybe just being totally shut down, depressed. And so therapy might be good for him in the context of it's a confidential space. So it might be the only person he's able to be truly 100% honest with, because therapists won't tell anybody that you're gay if you tell them or that you have gay tendencies or urges. And just kind of working through how can he live a life that lessens some of his distress. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be out and you have to be proud and you have to be like, making everybody know, because I get that in certain situations, the reality of your situation in order for you to feel safe, in order for you to feel okay, you can't always be 100%. I mean, I hate to say yourself, but kind of like there are certain environments in which as therapists, we allow our clients to educate us on how much can they be themselves and be self-actualized, but also be safe in their environment? Because there's cultural aspects to it, you know, family aspects to it, where you don't, in order to feel better for yourself, you don't have to, like I said, be 100% whatever you identify all the time. If you have family that will never accept you, or if you have a culture that you'll be unsafe in if you are out. And so maybe working with him in terms of what do you think you are able to do with your life and your identity to help you feel at least a bit better, almost like harm reduction.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
That you feel okay, that feels possible for you.
So when you say harm reduction, what does that mean? I think that's a term that's a very psych term. I don't think everybody's going to be familiar with.
Harm reduction is mostly used in the context of addiction. A lot of times when I hear it mostly, it's like hardcore, like heroin, meth, like the ones that'll kill you.
Right. And risky sexual behavior.
Yeah. And so harm reduction is, it's the opposite of the model that abstinence only model, which is either you are using and you're hurting yourself and you're not helping yourself, or you are totally clean and you are working towards progress. Harm reduction is the gray area of that.
Right, which science alert. Science alert!
Yes.
Abstinence only doesn't work.
Yeah.
For anything.
So harm reduction is this idea that if we can get you just a little bit into a safer place, and if that means using, like, if we're going to do the drug analogy, using clean needles, like a needle exchange, if you can, instead of using every day, or can you get down to like 4 days a week? So it's kind of a sliding scale towards maybe abstinence one day if that's possible. But it's a very non-judgmental. It's very asking the client to lead you of what they feel like they're capable of. So, and then you're not pushing your agenda on them, so they feel more empowered that this is a choice they can make. It's baby steps, basically.
Yeah. And also right, just and helping, acceptance. Yeah, and also helping them be more aware and more cognizant of the health outcomes. Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes that's a big part of harm reduction, of saying, well, you don't have to stop, but maybe what about using clean needles, or what about making sure that you're always using condoms, or, I mean, like, there's certain things that we can just help kind of help people limit the health outcomes that could be, that'll be a reality if they continue to do things on in the path that they're going on.
Right. And I think an important thing to mention about it is that where there becomes like a fundamental clash often, and you see this in politics a lot, more so with sex ed, but you see this a lot, is that abstinence only is the only way we go. It's the only one we'll sponsor. And
well, it's the only one that's going to keep you safe.
Right. It's the only one that's going to keep you safe. But the reality of it, that works for some people. Some people do well with, like, the AA-type cold turkey. Some people, but the vast majority of people, particularly who are deep, deep into addiction, can make positive changes and make impact in their life that maybe wouldn't have been possible if they believed the all or nothing. Whereas they can see that, like, with guidance and shaping, which is a core point of person-centered therapy, is that, you know, people will grow like a plant towards the light. And if you can provide a light for them, it's a way forward. And I think that it's important for people to know that abstinence is a part of that. Like, maybe if that's where the, you know, a reasonable goal for what the client wants to see, if they, that's something that's talked about, it's brought up, but only at stage appropriate time. Like, we can work towards that, but let's work towards making you safe first.
And I don't want to compare sex, like, homosexuality to drug addiction, but in the context that I was saying, it is the baby steps of what baby steps can he take in order to feel more comforted in his life, and to feel more relief about who he is, and to feel more wholeness with who he is, and to feel less distress and less depression.
Right.
And things like, I mean, I'm making a lot of assumptions about what this fictional character's life would look like, but in that it could look something like, I can resolve with myself that me being gay is not a bad thing, but that doesn't mean that I have to tell anybody about it. Can I live with that? Is that as far as I can go?
Right.
And so letting the client lead you, because I think there's the misunderstanding that you're going to come in and a therapist will be like, you have to be able to do this in order to feel better, or that we have to go all the way to the big goal for you to feel relief. But a lot of times, like Ben said, we're person-centered in that I'm willing to do what you're willing to do if that's going in the right direction for you.
Yeah, I talk a lot with clients. I feel like I talk a lot about, like, the I'm going to come this far, but I'm only going to come to where you're ready to come to. And the most important thing being a therapist, I think, is really meeting people where they are and helping them work on the things that are important to them. Because the truth of the matter is, we're here to help you. You're coming to us. We're trained to help you meet the goals that you want to meet. It's not about what we think you should do, or that there's only one answer, there's only one outcome. There's almost always multitude of ways that you can seek the changes that you want in your life.
And I guess, I mean, the real question with Oliver would be, what exactly is he coming into therapy to achieve? Is he wanting to be out and proud and fulfilled in his identity? Because by the time he came to therapy, it might be 2004, you know, or something like that. And he might, you know, and he might be ready to be more prominent, or maybe by then is, I mean, this sounds bad, but maybe by then his parents will be dead and he'll feel like he can finally be out. And so, I mean, it could, there's evolving, especially with sexuality and sexual orientations and culture in the past, like 40 years have evolved so quickly and so much, not enough, but that by the time he actually got into the door of a therapist, it could be a myriad of,
absolutely,
of what he is wanting to really accomplish. Or it could just be like, I'm feeling really depressed, but I want my marriage to, I want to stay with my wife because we have kids.
Right.
So how do I compromise
and he does
being miserable
kids.
About my sexuality, but not wanting to leave, but stay in my marriage. And so it could be a bunch of stuff, and you kind of, and your job as a therapist isn't to impose your moral upon them. Even if that moral is, well, you shouldn't be living a lie in your marriage. Like, that's not for you as the therapist to decide.
No. Never. Never decided. It might be on you as a therapist to have the discussion of, like, would an open marriage be something that could be talked about? Is, yeah. You know, is this something that could be realistic for you? It's not something you have to tell other people other than your wife, but is this... Mm-hmm. Or your other partner, is this something you could talk about where, you know, things are open, or whether you're able to have sexual experiences with people of the same gender? Like,
and also, I mean, and what probably the realest talk you might have at some point is if you keep hitting a barrier of progress because he's only going to feel so much better staying in this marriage or not being self-actualized with his sexuality. And that might be a talk you have with him at some point. If they're getting frustrated with therapy, be like, I hear you. I don't know how much farther we can go unless this or this changes. But that doesn't mean you have to, but this might be resigning yourself or working through that this might be the way you always feel if you want these circumstances to stay the same.
Right.
And that might be what you work on. That could be grief. That could be grief counseling in that way. Like, you might have to go through the loss of never being in a truly romantic relationship or never being or compromising your children over your happiness, which sounds not great. But those are the choices people make. And those, depending on your morals, that might be more important to you than your own contentment is my children's security and contentment. And so working them, maybe the guilt and the shame that they have through that.
Yep. All right. So do we have any final thoughts on the film?
I mean, I think what I took away from it as a straight woman, I went into seeing this movie not really thinking I would connect with it that strongly, because it is a gay coming of age story, if you want to like sum it up in simplistic terms.
Sure.
And that's how it's advertised. Mm-hmm. And that's how the book is advertised. So I went into it being like, maybe it'll be beautiful, but I don't know if I'll connect with it. So I think what surprised me, and what I think I've been encouraging others to go see it, is it feels so for a story that has such specific labels to it, it feels like such a universal story.
Right.
Like, nothing about Elio's story didn't feel like I could also identify with, like being young and being sexual, not knowing what to do with it, and who you are and your parents and feeling like a spazoid. And like, and the speech at the end always makes me cry, because I think what he gets from his parents is what we all want, which is positive, unconditional positive regard and acceptance from our parents, no matter who we are, what we do. And so I encourage people to see this, even if you don't think you'll relate to it, because it's such... It is shocking how universal it felt when I first saw it.
So I love this movie, and I love it every time that I watch it, and I've watched it a lot. I bought it as soon as I could, and it's just a really, I think it just makes me feel happy about the fact that there's a possibility that parents could be like this, and there's a possibility that this experience is out there for other people, and also that it would be really... how amazing it would be for other people to be able to see this. So I definitely encourage people to see this movie, because I think it connects on a lot of different levels.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a very well done movie. I liked it. I thought going into it as a straight male that, like, this is going to be a different experience for me, because this is a world I have no personal experience in. But as watching it, the 17-year-old realizations and reliving for me, like, one of my instincts that came back was like, my 17-year-old self needs to apologize to every woman I encountered at that point in time in my life. And probably for every woman, you know, ever.
Well, it's that thing when you're that young, you kind of, unfortunately, sometimes plow through other people's feelings because you can't help but be so self-centered.
Right. And you don't know any better, and you're trying to figure out who you are and what's going on. But I thought that the relationship depicted, particularly with his dad, but also with his mom, was like a wonderful thing for anybody to see, to experience and learn about what a supportive relationship looks like and how it could be managed and how you can actually have a positive relationship with your parent or with your child if you're able to be open and accepting and to see how far that actually goes in getting people to talk to you and how well adapted that makes them and able to handle all of the struggles that life comes and learn that they can reach out to you when they need to. So I thought of all of that, it was really well done. And it was also pretty eye-opening for me because I've never been a gay 17-year-old who's learning to come into my own sexuality, which is different than what is traditionally accepted. I didn't have to go through that. But for me to be able to see that and see like the struggles that they both went through, I thought was something that was really important. And particularly as the society is starting to really show accelerated change into accepting that, you know, people have been gay forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
It's not a new thing.
It's not a new thing. It's not. It's not a new thing, but the constraints around it can cause pretty intense psychological harm to people and can cause a lot of confliction about who I am and how am I going to be accepted, how am I going to fit into this world. And I thought that this showed a good depiction of the two different sides of it, of Oliver, who'd been on the other side of it. He's a little older, he's experienced more and is a little more cautious and guarded about it, whereas Elio is feeling more accepted and he's pushing through and like just acting on his impulses and his instincts as a, you know, emerging gay male. And I thought that that was something that would be important, particularly if you were a gay male, to see and explore this film. So I didn't have a lot of expectations going into it, but after seeing it, I think that it was a really wonderful film and it's definitely one that should be watched.
So thank you for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Blog Talk Radio. And you can also email us at popcornpsychology@gmail.com with any questions, concerns, feedback of any kind. Thank you.